Good morning. Good to be with you this morning. I want to welcome all of our visitors. And if you are visiting this morning, you haven't done so yet, please, at any point in the next few minutes, over the next half hour, take a minute and fill out that little card there. There's a card in the pew back in front of you that just helps us know if you were here and be able to welcome you for being here. And we're thankful that you've chosen to join us this morning. And so take a minute and do that if you haven't already. I want to thank you also for your patience while we were gone. Abby and I had a great trip. Many of you had asked us about that, and we're just thankful to be able to get away for a little bit and take the two-year delayed 10-year anniversary trip because of COVID. just thankful for your patience and glad to be back with you. There is no place like home, I will say that. Although, as I was sharing this morning in our Bible class, we were welcomed home this morning by hitting a deer. And the car's okay. I think actually the hitting might be a little bit too harsh of a word. We glanced the deer, fortunately. I was sure that it was a trip to the body shop, but I think we got off okay with it. But of course, welcome back to Monroe County, right? It is deer season now, and we are going to be going into the rut here soon, But glad to be back, glad to be with you this morning, and we're going to continue our sermon series that we started 2 weeks ago before we left, and that is the abundant life. And so if you want to turn your Bibles to Ephesians chapter 5, we're going to talk about abundant marriage this morning, abundant marriage. And I am going to attempt as best I can to share something that it always feels like when I dive into this topic that there's just not enough time to give it justice and to do this well. And so I'm going to try to, with the limited time that we have, to talk about something that is so, so important and so very difficult at times. I remember when I was first getting into ministry, a seasoned preacher told me something that kind of shocked me. It was a moment of transparency as he and I were talking about ministry, and I think I must have been asking him some questions. And he shared with me that in his ministry life, that he always dreaded doing weddings and actually enjoyed doing funerals. Your reaction was about like mine. I kind of looked at him, and I probably had this confused look on my face, because what he said next explained what he had just said, because he probably saw how startled I was that he would say something so odd. And he said, well, in my experience, he said, I've been able to help people more, I feel like, in dealing with death. And it seems like in a wedding, I always have to wonder if they're going to be together after 10 years. He had served in enough time in ministry to be able to see those he had married over the span of his time in ministry, and unfortunately had the painful experience of watching many of those that he had married over the years in ministry not make it. And as a minister, I can tell you that that's always a difficult thing, because if you've never done a wedding, you can't imagine, but you as a minister pour yourself into that wedding, it's not just the ceremony, it's the marriage. And as you participate in that ceremony, you stand before God and essentially put your stamp of approval on this marriage. And so when it goes south, when something doesn't work out right, you always feel like, I didn't do enough, or I should have done something more, or I wasn't able to help. And whether or not, of course, we know that's not the minister's fault, but there is a part of you that gets wrapped up in there. And I always thought that was interesting, his observation of feeling like he was able to be of more help to the family in their grief than he was to the couple getting married. At different points in our marriage, and I asked Abby if I could share this with you, so if you're wondering what I'm going to say next, if we checked it by each other, I did. At different points in our marriage, Abby and I have been to counseling. And I fully believe in the benefit of marital counseling, by the way, as I've mentioned to you before, because it has benefited us. And I remember one particular counseling session, we were dealing with one of those issues. It wasn't anything groundbreaking, but it was just one of those issues that you keep bumping up against. throughout your marriage. And if you've been married any number of years, you know what that is. It's just every couple has it. There's something that you can't get past. And it just seems like you keep stumbling over it. It's like that thing, you know, in your living room that you always walk around the corner and you trip over it every single time, or you stub your toe on it every single time. And at some point, it becomes really annoying. And you're like, I don't understand if we're ever going to get over this. And I remember talking with the counselor about it, and we were trying to figure this out. And I remember him telling me something that just, oh man, it clicked. He commented that we had to mourn the loss of what wouldn't be in our marriage. To be able to get past it, we had to mourn the loss of what wouldn't be. And all marriages have this, by the way. It's nothing new or unique to us, but all of us come into marriage with a certain set of hopes and expectations of what marriage is going to be like, what it's like to be married, what our spouse is like. And then we're surprised often because it's just how it is when you get to experience living with someone in a 24/7 environment over a number of years. You find out that you have some differences because you're human beings. And what your hopes and dreams and expectations are of that person or of the marriage itself sometimes has to die for you to be able to move past what never will be, because whether you like it or not, they're not going to learn how to squeeze the toothpaste right. They're not going to put the toilet paper on the right way. They're not going to be able to get rid of the snoring or the whatever it is that you don't like. They're always going to not want to watch your kind of movie where you want to watch this one. It's all these things that encapsulate, and I'm obviously using funny things, but there are deeper problems. Deeper issues that we deal with, right? And what we often find is that marriage is a sort of a give and take experience where we have to negotiate things and we have to come to terms with the way things are. And that's not to say that marriage isn't beautiful. Beautiful picture of what God has done for us. I mean, this passage that we're going to look at this morning describes it in about the best way possible in the entire Bible. That our relationship with each other, male, female, that God created us in a unique way to connect, to fulfill His image. When God talks about creating male and female in the beginning, He talks about creating them in His image. And there's a lot of people that think, and I would be one of these, that argue that we are not fully in the image of God unless we are together, male and female, expressing the fullness of God's attributes and qualities and characteristics, because God has created us different to be able to express that as gendered people, male and female together. And so marriage is a beautiful picture of this unique relationship that God has given us in our world to be able to describe not only His image, but also what He's done for us. As Paul talks about in our passage, that Christ came to sacrifice, that He came to die, and that our relationship with Christ, being the church, is pictured in marriage as the husband and the wife coming together, the husband sacrificing for the wife submitting to her husband, and being able to connect in a way that is unique among all human relationships. It's a beautiful picture of what God has done for us. But unfortunately, many marriages don't make it. There is pain in marriage. There are flaws. There are frustrations. There are shortcomings, like we mentioned just a few moments ago. Many marriages don't make it. The pain was just too much. The bumping up together was just too much, and the pain became so great that there was no other way out, right? It just became too much to deal with, and so the marriage ended. Or the marriage stayed together, but barely. And what you end up having are two people cohabitating, but living very different lives, far short of the one flesh ideal of Genesis 2:4. And you essentially have roommates. But what if it could be better? And this is what I want to explore with you this morning, is what if it could be better? What if marriage is better than could be better than what you're experiencing it right now? What if our marriages could be saved from mediocrity and just getting by and tolerating each other just long enough to be able to eat, sleep, and do what we need to do and go to the places we need to go? What if Christ could help make us better spouses? Better husbands, better wives. Not that we're perfect, not that we never argue, not that we never have difficulties and frustrations, but that we could in some way come to an understanding together because of our shared relationship with God. And we could live this life abundantly in marriage. We talked about that at the beginning of our series, John chapter 10, verse 10. Jesus, talking about being the good shepherd, talks about giving life to his sheep and coming to give life. And not just life, John 10, 10, he says, I have come that they may have it abundantly. And this issue that we're talking about, abundant life, doesn't just start when we get to heaven, it starts now. Because when you made a commitment, when you made a promise to Jesus and chose to follow him, that was the beginning of a relationship with him, and that marked the beginning of him giving you this abundant life as the good shepherd. And so what I want to talk about this morning in our time together is looking at Ephesians chapter 5, verses 21 through 33, this passage here, and looking at what it is to have an abundant marriage. And let me just kind of level with you also. As a minister, I get this a lot. You know, people, we come to the Bible, understandably so, with problems, with issues, with difficulties that we're trying to solve, right, in our life, not just about marriage, but about parenting, about coworkers, about how to deal with, issues with a job, or all these problems that we come to the Bible with in life, and probably more than any other, the two that to top the list, marriage and parenting, get asked, well, how am I supposed to be a better husband? How am I supposed to be a better spouse? How am I supposed to be a better parent? And to be completely honest with you, the Bible doesn't talk about it a whole lot. I mean, think about it. Of all the passages in Scripture that we could write or talk about being a better spouse, a wife, or a husband, there's only maybe a small handful. I could probably count on this many fingers all the passages that you could name in the whole Bible of specifically talking to husbands and wives. That's not to say that there aren't principles that we can pull from other places in Scripture and apply them to our marriage to make us a better spouse. But as far as somebody, Paul, talking to us, writing a specific command to a spouse, a better husband, a better wife, there's just not a lot. And the same thing with parenting. There's not a lot. Sorry, parents, there's just not a lot of specifically parental advice in the Bible. But there are a couple passages, and they are significant. And this is one of probably the most significant when it talks about husbands and wives. And like I usually do, I like to give you a better understanding of what is going on in the passage rather than just diving in chapter 5, verses 21 through 33 and talking about that one. So let me back up for a minute and talk about where Paul has been and where he's going with this particular command to spouses, to husbands and wives. Turn, if you probably have to, as I do in my Bible, turn a page back and look at chapter 4, verses 17 and following. Paul has just gotten done discussing what it is to live as in the body of Christ. And he starts a new subject in verse 17 of chapter 4. He says, now this I say and testify to the Lord, that you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds. And what Paul begins to do from here on out to really into chapter 6 is to discuss what it looks like to no longer walk as the Gentiles do. He's writing to a bunch of Gentiles. He's writing to Gentile people. He says, I don't want you to live like that anymore. Because of your relationship with Christ, it should change how you act. And so he begins to discuss how it changes how I act. And so from chapter 4, verses 17 on, we talk about living this new life. We don't live like the Gentiles do. And then at the end of chapter 4, starting verse 25, into chapter 5, verse 1, he starts talking about specific behavior, positive and negative. Do this, don't do that. Be angry, but don't sin. Don't steal, work. Don't let corrupting talk come out of your mouth, but only what is good for building up. All these specific behaviors of what it looks like to live not like the Gentiles, but in this new life. And then in the beginning of chapter 5, he gets into the subject of sexual morality, which he talks for a good number of verses about. Avoid this. Verses 15 and through 20, he talks about walking wisely among the outsiders, among those in your community, being careful to make use of the time. And then in 21, we get to this section where we are currently. And our particular passage about marriage sits in the midst of a bigger section of what are called household codes. In the ancient world, there were certain things called household codes of relational ways that you interacted with people in your household. And in a household in the ancient times, it would include the father, the mother, the children, the servants, anybody else in the house constituted the household. So that's why he talks about masters and slaves. Because in the house, there were also servants and slaves. And so he talks about how to deal with your master, servants, and also your slaves, masters, your husbands, your wives, your children, how to interact together in this new relationship that you find yourself in Jesus. And then he finishes out in chapter 6, verses 10 through 20 about the armor of God, that this is a spiritual battle. All of these things go back to that section starting in verse 17 of chapter 4 that we just talked about. But let's deal specifically with chapter 5, 21 through 33, this marriage topic that he gets into. Now, there's been a lot of ink spilled on this particular section. There have been books that have been written. There have been seminars that have been conducted. There have been commentaries. There have been lectures. There have been movies made. I mean, all this stuff, a lot of energy and time over the years has been spent trying to deal with what we're going to talk about this morning. And usually, here's what it boils down to. Wives versus husbands. Wives, here's what you do. Husbands, here's what you do. And there's a bulleted list. You could even go down through it and look at wives. This is what your duties are as a good wife. Husbands, this is what your duties are as a good husband. And this is all important information, but I think it misses the point. Because when you start looking point by point about what's my duty as a good wife or what's my duty as a good husband, you miss the greater picture of what Paul is trying to do with this passage. In ministry, you deal with marriages that are in trouble, unfortunately. And there's a lot of reasons that marriages get into trouble. I mean, lots of different reasons that marriages get into trouble. But often, if I could boil it all down, all the reasons for marriages being in crisis, here's what it often comes down to. He's not or she's not. She isn't, he's not. There's some reason, there's some inequity that's going on in the relationship. Something's not being done by the other spouse, the other person, that causes the individual to feel like they have a justification and a reason for the way things are. And as long as that continues to be the case, there will never be any movement in progress. Because as long as we continue to feel offended by the other person and angry at the other person, we will always be able to justify whatever it is that we're currently doing. And we do this in life. I mean, it's not just in marriage, right? Have you ever had an argument with an employer about something? Something that's done that you don't think is fair that they did and you had to suffer the consequences about? And you go around with the attitude of, well, I'm not going to work is hard now because they're not a good employer. Or I'm done with this business because I just don't want to deal with it anymore. It's, you know, the grievance list starts being written in your mind and all the reasons why you have justification for acting the way that you do. And we become gridlocked. We justify our own behavior and we'll never get past the issue as long as we continue to do that. And many times the Ephesians 5 passage becomes the clobber passage. And we literally as Christians will go there with our spouse and say, well, look, you're not doing this for me. Husband, you're not loving me as Christ loved the church. You're not sacrificing for me. You're being selfish. You always go hunting and fishing when I'm sitting here with the kids by myself. And I'm taking them all the places that they need to go, and you're off doing your own thing. You don't care anything about what's going on in the house, in the family, because you're distracted. Or husbands. Well, you just disrespect me all the time. You're not submitting to me. I never feel like I have a voice in this relationship because you do whatever you want. And then I have to come in and clean up to the mess when I come back home and everything's disorderly. And then when I try to talk to you about it, you get all upset at me and you can't listen to me. You're not submitting to me. Sound familiar? at all. Maybe not in the specific instance, but in the general flow of the conversation. And it becomes a you're too, or you're not. And we use this passage as our way of arguing our point. And here's why I think that getting down into the weeds of the do's and the don'ts often leads us to failure almost immediately, is because we miss something that Paul says on the front end of the passage, because we're too concerned with the specifics of the do's and the don'ts that he gets into later. But check out what he says here at the beginning of the verse, of the passage, as we looked at it, verses 21 through 33. Look at how he starts 21. Look at 21 with me. He says, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. The starting point has to be mutual submission. And if I don't start with that attitude in mind, if I don't begin my relationship with an attitude of mutual submission to the other, that it's not about getting my way first and foremost, it's about making sure that the other's needs are met, then I will always live in this world of I'm not getting what I need in this relationship. The famous marriage therapist Lyndon B. Johnson once said, that was supposed to be a joke, you can laugh at that. Lyndon B. Johnson, if you ever listened to him talk, wasn't anything but. He one time cracked at a piece of marriage advice. He says, I've learned that only two things are necessary to keep one's wife happy. First, let her think she's having her own way. And second, let her have it. And we can laugh. It's always said, that's good. That's good. It's probably a woman, if I had to guess. And we can laugh about that. But there's a nugget of truth in there. And it's not about always just giving in, okay? I'm not just talking about you just do whatever the other person wants, if it's your wife or it's your husband. You just never ever ask for anything in the relationship. You never act like you need anything in the relationship. It's always about the other person, because that will often become a point of bitterness and resentment down the road, if that's the attitude, if it's an overly generous position. But there is a nugget of truth in what President Johnson said, because mutual submission, if both take that angle, if both are looking at it like that, both parties end up getting what they need. Because no one feels like they're being taken advantage of in a relationship. Have you ever felt like you've been taken advantage of? Not just in a marriage, I'm talking about in a relationship. You ever feel like somebody's using you and you're not getting what you need out of the relationship? And you just keep giving and giving and giving, and they're not doing anything. They're not giving any investment in the relationship. That's exhausting, right? That drains you. And there's only so much of that we can take as people. But before Paul starts into his individual address to husband and wife, he starts out with a general command for mutual submission by both parties. Our problem is, and you probably didn't even look at it because it wasn't in the marriage section. Look at your Bible. If your Bible divides this by sections, like mine does, mine starts off in chapter 5, verse 22, by saying husbands and wives. It doesn't even include verse 21. And so that obviously automatically gives us the option to throw out verse 21 because we don't think it applies, when actually it does. It's the foundation block for what Paul's going to say next. If nothing's done out of mutual submission, then everything that Paul says from 22 on seems like a bunch of obligations. And as long as the other person's fulfilling their obligation, I'm okay. But when they stop fulfilling their obligations, now all of a sudden we have a problem. And I feel cheated. And I'm not getting what I need. Mutual submission is an attitude. It goes beyond how am I going to get what I want to how am I going to give what they need. So what happens when we don't start there? When we don't start with this mutual submission piece, we become focused on self. What am I getting out of this relationship? Is it feeding my needs? Is it doing what I expected? And then once I stop getting what I need, or I'm out, or I just stop responding, we quiet quit a marriage. You know, that phrase is being thrown around the marketplace right now, quiet quitting, like when you just stop producing for your employer and you just are there. Well, we quiet quit marriage. We're just there. We haven't divorced. We haven't said, oh, I don't want to be married anymore, or I don't love you anymore. We just quiet quit. And we just say, well, you know, if they're not giving what I need, then I'm just going to go elsewhere and find my fulfillment in life with a hobby or a job or another relationship with a girlfriend that I have, not a friend that's a girl, women, right? Have you ever seen someone quiet quit a marriage? I'll be honest with you, you know, one of the red flags to quiet quitting is the sexual relationship. This may be more than you want to know, but I think it's important to talk about because it's not something we're comfortable talking about. But frequency and engagement of the sexual relationship is highly dependent on the level of health in the marriage. And once relational engagement stops, once we stop mutually submitting to each other, sex suffers. Frequency and enjoyment of. And that's not to say, you know, it always has to be a certain number of times or a certain way. That's just to say that if you start realizing that, hey, I'm not getting what I need out of relationship, or I'm not getting what I need out of relationship, and you look around and your sexual relationship in a marriage hasn't been great either, and it's not because of medical reasons, might be a red flag. Might be a time to have a conversation with your spouse and say, hey, look, I'm not sure what's going on, but I just don't feel like we're really firing on all cylinders here. And I'd like to talk about that. Is there something that I'm not doing that you need more of me and engagement in our relationship? So let's talk about how, you know, because that's always what we want to talk. We say, well, that's a great idea, Scott. You know, how do you mutually submit to each other in a relationship? How does this, what does this actually look like? Here's what I would say first. Stop trying to get what you want out of the relationship and give your spouse what you need. Grieve the loss. Marriage is not going to fulfill all of your hopes and dreams about life. I lament the fact that in our culture, we hold marriage to almost godlike status. Same with children, but that's another conversation. But marriage, you know, I mean, think about it. Go to Disney World. You ever been to Disney World? Seen Disney movies, you know, at least the older Disney movies, maybe not so much anymore. The older Disney movies, it's like, oh, the prince comes, and it solves all the problems, and all of a sudden they live happily ever after and never argue. Get real, right? Seriously, Snow White and Prince Charming had arguments, I'm sure. Absolutely. It doesn't happen like that. That's not real life. But we teach our kids that. You sit down your little girl in front of a TV, and she watches Cinderella. And I'm not saying, please don't, you know, say I'm not saying don't watch Cinderella. I'm just saying that this is the message that we give ourselves so that when we become of age to marry, we get so enwrapped in this relationship with somebody and we can't see straight and we start thinking that they're going to solve all of our problems or that we're going to fix them. How many of you have ever seen somebody go into a relationship thinking that they're going to fix that person? Doesn't happen. Or we'll just have kids and they'll get better. Yeah. Keep telling yourself that. Gets worse. And so we deal with these expectations and we never grieve the loss. And that's not to say that marriage can't be great. Marriage can be great as long as we let go of the thinking that it's going to make my life complete, that it's going to fix all of my problems. And it's going to be an eternally wonderful state of life. Actually, what's really interesting is go back and read what the ancient people thought of marriage and the attitudes of people in like the first century when Paul would have been writing this, what their views of marriage were. Very, very different. Very different. The fundamental reason for marriage in the first century was to continue to survive. It was a needs thing. We have made it something much more. And so we need to, at some point, be able to negotiate the differences of our relationship and figure that, hey, it's not going to satisfy all the things that I thought I was going to get out of this relationship. It's going to be a way of connection, but it's not going to be the ultimate connection. The ultimate connection is in Jesus Christ. And both becoming more sacrificial. Now, I recognize here this morning, we're sitting in a room of, 150 plus people. Not everybody is married, and not everybody is married to a Christian. And so you might be sitting here thinking, well, that's great for you, you know, and that's great if your spouse wants to do this or if they're a Christian, but what if they're not a Christian? What am I supposed to do? I'm not married to a believer. I'm not married at all. Well, if you're not married at all, I guess the whole thing is kind of lost. But if you are married, you're just not married to a Christian. What do I do with that? How do I deal with it? For some, I'll be completely honest, this might be a one-way street for you. This mutual submission piece might be a one-way street for a long time. Maybe for the entire marriage. Let me read you something, though. If that's your situation, from Paul in his letter to the First Corinthians, or to the Corinthians, the first letter that we have, to the Corinthians, chapter 7. First Corinthians, chapter 7. This is Paul dealing with some questions by the Corinthians about marriage, and specifically asking Paul, you know, I'm not my husband, my wife, they're not Christians. Should I separate from them? I've become a Christian now, and because they're not interested in faith, should I leave the marriage? Should I leave the relationship? Look what he says. Verse 12, chapter 7, he says, to the rest I say, not I, or to the rest I say, I, not the Lord, that if any brother or sister has a wife or a husband who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. She should not divorce him. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. For how do you know, verse 16, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? Look, I can't promise you anything, but there is an element to a marriage in which one person is a Christian and the other is not. And you walk away, you thinking, I'm just going to have to continue to sacrifice myself for this other person without the benefit of them being interested in the other direction, of sacrificing for me. There is an element that Paul says, you make your husband, you make your wife holy because of your sacrifice for them. And how do you not know that at one point they might wake up and understand the truth and come to a faith in Jesus because of your sacrifice, because of your submission? And so I would say this, mutual submission in a relationship is necessary, whether you're married to a Christian or not. If you are married to a Christian, then great. It'll make your relationship better because you're both mutually submitting. If you're married to a non-believer, your submission to him or her is necessary for a different reason, because it might be the only picture of Christ that they ever get. I know that sounds harsh and sensitive, and you probably are thinking, well, that's easy for you to say, Scott, you're married to a believer. I know. It is easy for me to say. But I would say this. It's a lot more like Christ. submitting, giving of yourself to someone that doesn't necessarily have the same interest. Think about Jesus on the cross. He's submitting himself. He's giving of himself to a bunch of people that could care less, right? I mean, he's literally laying down his life. He's going to die for a bunch of people that are spitting on him, hitting on him, abusing him, who will never care anything about what he's doing. And I would say the spouse who continually submits themselves to an unbelieving spouse, without any guarantee of that spouse ever coming to faith, is more a picture of Jesus than the believing couple who are in mutual submission to each other. Either way, if you're doing what you should in marriage will sanctify you. Marriage makes us holy. Marriage makes us more like Christ. Notice both addresses, and I'm almost done, so hang with me. I know some of you are getting glazed over looks. I'm sorry. Hang with me for a little bit longer. Notice both addresses, back in chapter 5 of Ephesians, include to the wife and to the husband. Both examples talk about looking more like Jesus. Verse 23 for the wife, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to their husbands. In other words, wives, as you submit to your husbands in faith, in biblical marriage, you become the model of what Jesus did and what the church does with Jesus in their relationship. Verse 25 for the husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Husbands, if you love your wives well, you become the example of what Christ did for the church on the cross. And so let me end it with this. Asking this question this morning, are you in submission to your spouse this morning? Are you always looking for the better in them and for them? Are you not so much concerned about what you might get out of the relationship as what you might give? And I know for some of you, you feel like I've been giving my whole life and I've never gotten anything. I know. And I'm sorry. Sometimes it doesn't work to be a two-way street. Refer back to what we already talked about with Jesus, right? But if we take this attitude of always looking for what we need out of relationship rather than what we give, most likely we will become disappointed at some point. I wonder what kind of reaction you'd get if you went home, sat down with your spouse and say, hey, just read this verse. I want you to know, I'm going to be more like this. I want to be in submission to you. And it's not a male-female thing. It's not a, you need to make me a sandwich. It's not a, you need to do this for me. It's a, hey, I want to love you well, and I want this marriage to look good because it ultimately shows the example of Jesus. I wonder what your spouse would do. You just might become more like Jesus in the process. There's so much more that can be said about this issue, this topic. This could be a series of lessons for a month or more about abundant marriage. But I think, and here's where I'll end, and I'll shut up, that if anybody should have a good marriage, it should be us. Should it not? I mean, if anybody should have a healthy, functioning, good marriage, not perfect marriage, just a good marriage, it should be us as Christians, because we have the foundation of Jesus. We have the model for marriage and what Jesus did on the cross. And the more we start thinking about what we can give in the marriage and what we can sacrifice for the sake of the other, the better off we'll be. And so I challenge you this week, stop always going to, I'm not getting blank, or she's not this, or he's not that, because that's not the way that marriage was formed and founded. We have a song of invitation, as we always do. Here in a moment we're going to sing. Jeff's going to get back up and offer an invitation. And if you need to respond to the invitation itself, or if something else in your life is going on, we'd like to help and pray for you. We invite you to come as we stand and sing this next song.